The next day, that is to say, the day following the article that Nip just read you, the second part in this Le Matin series appeared about Stibaum. This is from Le Matin of June 21st, 1984, and it's headlined, On the Track of the Leopard, by Fabrizio Calvi. By the way, the leopard referred to here is the Leopard tank, a West German heavy tank. Continuing, beginning with the article. Eugene Bartholomaeus escaped the curiosity of the Australian police. His companions in the CIA protected him well, and it is they who put him in contact with the Roman engineer Glauco Partel, the man who took it upon himself to find clients for the devices. I'm going to read that last couple sentences again. Eugene Bartholomaeus escaped the curiosity of the Australian police. His companions in the CIA protected him well, and it is they who put him in contact with the Roman engineer Glauco Partel, the man who took it upon himself to find clients for the devices. The Italian, as he explained to Carlo Palermo, who indicted him last year, had just quit his work at SAI, where he was occupied fabricating missiles. He didn't yet know what he was going to do. It was then that he received at his Rome office a telex proposing that he sell a lot of 66 Cobra helicopters, which the Americans couldn't sell in Iran because of the change of regime. The engineer told the judge, quote, "The helicopters were in an airport in Belgium ready for delivery. The finances had to pass through the credit bank of Anvers, but I wasn't able to find buyers, and the helicopters were recently destroyed during NATO maneuvers," unquote. The first setback didn't break the confidence of Bartholomaeus or the Americans. Partel continued. One of his accomplices, Carlo Bertoncini, an Italian industrialist from Pomacia, told the judge how, in October of 1982, he negotiated with the Roman engineer to sell 116 tanks and 20 helicopters to the Somalian president, Siad Barre. When he received the two men in his office on 17th of October, 1982, the African chief of state specified that he had asked his services to check with Washington on the credentials of Partel. He explained that he had obtained all the necessary guarantees. Moreover, the sale went through. And Judge Palermo has in his dossier a copy of the contract signed by Glauco Partel and the Somalian Minister of Finances. And when the magistrate asked the engineer where his arms came from, he replied, "The Americans," unquote. Ex-agent of the National Security Agency, reseller of arms from the CIA, the missile expert explained to the Trento judge why the American intelligence services wanted at all cost to sell their surplus. Quote, "The market in arms is divided into two categories, official sales of one government to another on the one hand, and more discreet transactions on the other, which bring in, with government blessing, a series of intermediaries. Beyond its discretion, the second system presents an advantage. It permits the circulation of bribes." I would interrupt. Recall that bribing is blackmail, one of the major devices that P2 uses to enhance its power. Continuing. "For its private transactions, the American government demands three conditions: evidence of funds, approval of the State Department, and a purchase order on the part of the acquiring government. For private sales, one makes use of separate accounts directed by persons such as Eugene Bartholomaeus or one named Jenny Bende, B-E-N-D-E. They have the formal function of reseller and avail themselves of intermediaries, always with the approval of secret services," unquote. Reading that last sentence again. "They have the formal function of reseller and avail themselves of intermediaries, always with the approval of secret services," unquote. Partel was one of these intermediaries. He was able to establish contacts with an impressive number of governments, and the diagram of his organization that he made for Judge Palermo shows that he could intervene throughout the world. Carlo Bertoncini handled relations with Iraq and Iran. Vincenzo Giovanelli with Israeli and Arab contacts. The lawyer Campagna dealt with China. A certain Dutcher, D-U-T-C-H-E-R, was also in touch with China, but also with Saudi Arabia as well. And Marshall adds in parentheses here, this must be John Dutcher, Triple's contact, and quotes the Jack Anderson column of November 13th, 1981. So another probable link here between Stibaum Arms for Drugs Ring and the Triple Wilson CIA team. So that is a very, very important connection, the Dutcher connection. Reviewing this section very briefly, what we've looked at so far, Partel has basically said that Stibaum was used as a major organ of the American government, not only for unloading its surplus arms, but for basically compromising people who were incorporated as intermediaries in some of these sales. And the massive American involvement here, according to Partel, himself a national security agent, is not surprising in light of the fact that the head of this ring was a DEA agent. Bartholomaeus is working for CIA and a major branch originating in L.A.
Continuing with the article. The purchasing central functioned as effectively. Glauco Partel reserved for himself negotiations with the principal furnisher, the American State Department. Reuting, R-E-U-T-I-N-G, and the armorer Krateros talked with the Federal Republic of Germany. That's West Germany, of course. Bartholomaeus occupied himself with Britain and the Commonwealth countries on the one hand, and countries fabricating Soviet arms, like Korea, on the other. Richard Eschbach handled ties with the French. Partel was also in contact with an impressive number of foreign countries, specialized in the importation and export of arms. One of these brings us directly to the Nugenhan Bank of Sydney, the financial facade of the CIA for the international, for the arms traffic. Let me read that sentence again. One of these brings us directly to the Nugenhan Bank of Sydney, financial facade for the CIA for arms traffic. That which interests us is the French affiliate of Commerce International, headquartered in Cannes-sur-Mer, a little town in the Maritime Alps on the Côte d'Azur. Since 1981, this company has officially renounced the sale of arms, none of which prevented in 1982 it receiving from an Indian general an order for thousands of cartridges. The company that directs this officer asked Glauco Partel for a reference. According to the British review Private Eye, during the Falklands War, the head of Commerce International, or Commerce International, Frank Craddock, sold Argentina a lot of munitions similar to those requested by the Indians. Frank Craddock is of British nationality. His unpatriotic gesture was not appreciated on the other side of the channel. Still, according to Private Eye, he fled to Great Britain, where he was sought for bankruptcy fraud. Frank Craddock was tied to the arms trafficker Sarkis Sognalian, installed in Miami, where he directed an arms network for the CIA. Commerce International is a multinational company having affiliates in, among other places, Washington, Brussels, Cannes-sur-Mer, and Singapore. According to Mother Jones magazine, it was an emanation of the CIA. In Australia, journalists for the National Times affirmed that it was implicated not only in arms trafficking, but also in shadow operations directed by Nugenhan, apparently for the CIA, the destabilization of the Whitlam government in 1975. We just cut in to explain. That was the government of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, a labor government not sympathetic to some of the things the CIA was involved in, specifically, among others, the use of the Pine Gap station. The Gough Whitlam government was actually destabilized. Again, we're talking just like with Italy, was destabilized effectively, an ally by the United States CIA, because we did not approve of their attitude towards the CIA's operation in their own country. That was something Nugenhan was used for as a conduit for funds. Judge Palermo's researches weren't confined to the Western countries. In following the path of a lot of Leopard tanks, he stuck his nose into the Middle East. Among all the arms sold by Partel and his friends, Palermo also found tanks theoretically reserved to the NATO countries that were offered to Iraq and Iran. It has been years since people in Europe spoke of a traffic of this type in tanks fabricated by the FRG. Again, that's West Germany. There were rumors of a sale to Libya, but there was no proof until Palermo found evidence of even more disquieting transactions. The sale of Leopards had been negotiated by Glauco Partel. Who was the seller? Palermo asked. Quote, "It was a man named Reuting," Partel replied. "He was officially based in the Federal Republic of Germany and was occupied in import-export. He must be allied with the federal services," meaning with West German federal intelligence. "Reuting put himself in contact with us through Eugene Bartholomaeus when the latter was proposing to us to sell the 66 helicopters I told you about," unquote. To whom were the tanks offered? To Renato Gamba, proprietor of a small arms factory in the valley of Trompia, in the north of Italy, not far from Trento. It wasn't so much the personality of Gamba that held the most surprises for Judge Palermo as the men with whom he was in contact and for whose account he realized these transactions. Carlo Palermo had just quit the world of CIA vendors of the Eugene Bartholomaeus's to enter the no less troubling universe of Middle Eastern buyers allied to the Syrian services and directed by the astonishing Henry Arsan.
So basically, what we have here is an operation which appears to be primarily revolving around two organizations, one of them, the P2 and the related Banco Ambrosiano connections, the other being Western intelligence. Not only Arsan, but also Partel, Bartholomaeus, are working for elements of U.S. intelligence and or law enforcement. And according to Glauco Partzell, many of the operations of Steebaum were undertaken at the instigation of the U.S. government. So we have a massive, massive American intelligence connection to Steebaum here, in light of the fact that part of it originates in Los Angeles. That's not all that surprising. And remember now that there are a number of links, the main one being Bekir Cilenc, between this arms for drugs ring and the shooting of Pope John Paul II.
Absolutely.
Also worth remembering, Renato Gamba here, remember, was the person part of whose arms factory was financed by Brugge Izar. Part of Brugge Izar is owned by Ambrosiano.
All right, we're going to take another break at this point, and we will be back in just a few moments. The man who's going to sell you the stuff that you need, and the Trans Global Express. And it all adds up together here, folks, because we are talking about the world's largest guns for drugs and terrorism network, Steebaum. Originally, we were talking about it only in terms of the context of the Italian politics and the right-wing politics of the Italian P2 Propaganda Due Masonic Lodge, essentially a secret fascist government of Italy that was discovered and exposed in 1981. But that not only that, but as we've been talking about in the last part of the broadcast, the fact that Steebaum is intimately connected to a variety of United States intelligence operations, most notably the CIA, the Nugenhan Bank of Australia, and the Task Force 157 operations out there.
National Security Agency.
National Security Agency through Glauco Partzell, the man who set up the sale of 3 atomic bombs to Syria. And, of course, the operations of Frank Turpel and Ed Wilson, erstwhile, quote-unquote, ex-CIA agents in Libya who worked with Muammar Gaddafi and, according to Frank Turpel, also trained Mehmet Ali Agha, the would-be assassin of Pope John Paul II.
Now, that really is the key aspect of Steebaum, is the fact that one of the key 3 people in that organization, Bekir Cilenc, was reportedly the paymaster for the plot to shoot the Pope. And again, that with the massive connections between Western intelligence and the Steebaum ring, with the massive connections between the P2 and Ambrosiano complex and the Steebaum ring, calls seriously into question the so-called Bulgarian connection. We're basically going to blow that connection out of the water next week. Returning now to the series that Le Matin did about Steebaum, we're going to take a look at some Steebaum operations here, which go behind the Iron Curtain. Recall that there was a reference to Bulgaria and Yugoslavia as being transit countries. There were also some Steebaum dealings behind the Iron Curtain. Returning once again to Le Matin, this one from June 22nd, 1984. And again, translation, Jonathan Marshall. Research credit to Ted Rubenstein. Speaking of some of the Turkish associates of Henry Arsan, DEA agent and head of Steebaum, Le Matin and Fabrizio Calvi write as follows. One of the Turkish traffickers arrested was Tegmen Erdem, E-R-D-E-M, the first to explain to Palermo all the mechanisms of this contraband organization. In the past, Erdem had already furnished these same details to a DEA agent based in West Germany. The Turk claimed, moreover, to be himself an agent of the DEA and claimed that his agency number was SXY-2000. Quote, I knew Arsan in 1982 in the United States, unquote, Erdem explained to the judge. We were in California in the company of Mehmet Kantas. We had a reunion where Arsan recalled the sale of hundreds of Leopard 2 tanks and Cobra helicopters. Arsan also told us that he negotiated the sale of 50 or so M48 tanks. They were in Hamburg, supposed to be sent to their destination through a Danish port. When Arsan realized this, he billed the cost of transport based on the value of the Spanish port, excuse me. When Arsan realized this, he billed the cost of transport based on the value of the boat charged with convoying the arms. He told us then that Renato Gamba furnished the arms. In July of 1982, Tegmen Erdem did his first deal with Arsan and discovered the Syrian ramifications of the arms traffic. Arsan also served as intermediary between the Polish government and that of South Yemen to sell 56 tons of arms, 5,000 Kalashnikovs and 5,000 Tokarevs. But why did the Polish government use Arsan? Why did Arsan supply the Polish government with false documents attesting that the arms were destined for the Emirate of Qatar? Erdem got the response from Arsan's mouth. Quote, they explained that they didn't want the Soviets to know about the operations, so they wouldn't get a percentage. The Poles had a pressing liquidity problem. The deal brought them $1,800,000. Still, according to Tegmen Erdem, the first negotiations of which he was a part took place at the seat of the Polish ambassador in Vienna. Besides Arsan, the Polish delegation was composed of a functionary from the Defense Ministry named Andrzej Urbaniak, U-R-B-A-N-I-A-C. The sellers represented by Arsan. Tegmen Erdem and two Syrians associated with Arsan. Those two were named Abu Daoud, called George, and Mustafa Zenedine. Remember Abu Daoud, we're going to come back to him in a future broadcast some months down the line. For our purposes here, it should be noted not only that still another associate of Arsan, Tegmen Erdem, claims to be a DEA agent and even cited his number, but it's worth noting here that Arsan has dealings behind the so-called Iron Curtain, specifically in Poland, and the operations of Stibom behind the Iron Curtain would be of obvious interest and obviously could quite obviously be used as a vehicle by Western intelligence.
Okay, continuing, as Dave mentioned earlier, to the connections of these various agents and their connections specifically behind Iron Curtain countries, we're going to read from an article that was originally published in the San Jose Mercury of March 24th, 1983. The headline is, NBC says CIA agents under investigation. Dateline New York, AP Wire story. The Reagan administration is investigating whether the CIA station chief in Rome and two of his agents disobeyed orders in connection with the investigation of the shooting of Pope John Paul II, NBC News reported Wednesday. The three, whom the network by law did not identify, raised the ire of officials in Washington because they refused to stop, quote, discrediting the so-called Bulgarian connection in the inquiry of the papal shooting, NBC said. Mehmet Ali Aja, a Turkish gunman serving a life sentence for the attempted assassination of the Pope on May 13, 1981, has told Italian investigators that several Bulgarians helped him plan the attack. Quoting an unidentified key administration source, NBC said the three may be fired because they have allegedly disobeyed orders issued by the National Security Advisor William Clark and CIA Director William Casey. NBC said the Rome agents may have downplayed the Bulgarian connection because they did not want attention drawn to, one, an alleged close working relationship, unquote, between them and an Italian labor leader who was arrested as a Bulgarian spy. We'll get back to that. Two, the possible use of a guns and drug smuggling route between Sofia, Bulgaria, and Milan, Italy, to run CIA agents into Eastern Europe. Okay, two very intriguing things there. The last two things mentioned that supposedly would be the reasons that these CIA agents would be downplaying the Bulgarian connection and that would be upsetting the Reagan administration. The first, the reference to an alleged close working relationship between the CIA and an Italian labor leader who was arrested as a Bulgarian spy. The man they're referring to here is a man by the name of Luigi Scricciolo, spelled S-C-R-I-C-C-I-O-L-O. Luigi Scricciolo, we will be talking about at some length next week. Luigi Scricciolo is interestingly involved with Michael Ledeen, and through Michael Ledeen, possibly with Alexander Haig, is also involved with one of Mehmet Ali Aja's stories, like the Bulgarian connection, but it was one of the first of Mehmet Ali Aja's stories to fall apart under scrutiny, and will perhaps lead us in considering how it fell apart and where, to looking a little more closely into where Mehmet Ali Aja's stories come from in the first place. The second part, and for more useful for our purposes right in this show, because we'll get to Scricciolo next week, the possible use of a gun and drug smuggling route, obviously the Stibom route, between Sofia, Bulgaria, and Milan, Italy. Well, the idea that it's being used to run CIA agents into Eastern Europe is quite interesting. There is quite possibly some involvement by some level of the Bulgarian government in this operation, if nothing else. Just as in the American government, there are undoubtedly elements of the Bulgarian government that are quite corrupt enough to set up little elements on money-making operations on their own and to utilize their positions to put away private nest eggs.
Also, a couple of things to consider also is the fact that Bulgaria fought on the side of the Axis in World War II, and it's not unreasonable to suppose there might be some residual fascist elements in Bulgaria. Beyond that, too, there's always the very, very murky consideration of counterintelligence. In other words, spy versus spy, something we generally try to stay away from when we can. But a number of researchers that we've spoken with share the view that we have, which is that both sides knew what was going on with Stibom and were using this arms for drugs ring to help monitor the other's activities. Now, one of the aspects to, one of the things to consider in connection with the obvious involvement of U.S. intelligence with Stibom is the possibility of using that organization in order to obtain East Bloc guns for whatever purpose. Just exactly that suggestion was made in an issue of the Reader's Digest, specifically in the issue of November 1983, in an article about Stibom, but blaming the whole thing on the KGB in Bulgaria, in an article about Stibom by a man named Nathan Adams. The title of the article is Drugs for Guns. It's all about Stibom and basically makes the whole thing out to be a commie plot, which, as we've seen, is a massive exaggeration in light of all the P2 connections, the fact that it was headed up by a DEA agent and had all kinds of other U.S. intelligence connections. Interestingly enough, in this article, Drugs for Guns, Adams admits that the CIA was involved with the Stibom ring to a certain extent. He writes, incredibly enough, Western nations, perhaps unwittingly, have actually contributed to the conspiracy. For example, until recently, the CIA, via a German broker, was purchasing millions of dollars of Eastern Bloc weapons to equip anti-Sandinista guerrillas in Nicaragua. The weapons were supplied by Kintex. So according to Nathan Adams, Stibom was used to obtain AK-47s for the Contras in Nicaragua. And that may, in fact, be a pattern which is continuing to this day.
Indeed. And bear in mind, too, now, again, we don't have to examine every single one of these in a whole lot of detail, but it should be looked at this way. As Dave mentioned, one of the possible reasons for these connections between the CIA and their conduit into the Stibom operation would be, as Dave mentioned, a way to get Eastern European weaponry for whatever purposes they might desire. Now, one of the things that has been going on, for instance, on the Nicaraguan border, is that the Contras have been attempting, in some cases, or it has been alleged that they have attempted to make it look as though the Sandinistas were making raids into Honduran and Costa Rican territory. There have been times when the Sandinista government has admitted, yes, we made this attack on a Contra base. There have been other times when the Sandinistas have said, no, we did not do that. But what has been proffered as evidence on the behalf of the Contras to prove that the Sandinistas did it were bodies, corpses, which don't talk, and Eastern European Soviet bloc weapons. Now, if indeed AK-47s and the like are being shipped through the CIA from Stibom to the Contras in Nicaragua, it's very possible that they could be used for just this sort of provocation with exactly the same kind of motives as were being used by the Italian fascists during the strategy of tension days.
Exactly. And there are indications that this Bulgarian AK-47 connection may be continuous to this day in spite of the interdiction of the Stibom Arms for Drugs ring. In witness to that, we cite the following, this from the San Jose Mercury of September 1st, 1985. It's Dateline's headline, Nicaraguan Rebels Get Polish Rifles, U.S. Says. Nicaraguan resistance forces recently received a shipment of 10,000 Polish-made AK-47 rifles as part of a weapons deal worth an estimated $6 million, U.S. officials say. According to one official, the shipment was sent from the Bulgarian port of Burgas, B-U-R-G-A-S, and reached the resistance forces via a Latin American country hostile to the leftist Sandinista government. The country was not identified. So the Polish and Bulgarian AK-47 connection may be continuous to this day. We've seen Stibom transiting through Bulgaria and dealing with Poland in the past.
Now we're going to get off into another whole interesting area of speculation, which is nonetheless connected intimately, not only with what we're talking about tonight, but all the way back to what we were talking about in the first couple of broadcasts, namely the Operation Bernhardt. We think the Operation Bernhardt, the Operation Bernhardt operation, put together by Freddy Schwend and other SS people, that was at the time a source of counterfeit money for two purposes. One, to destabilize mostly British currency, but also to provide a source of spending money for the Nazis when they went into exile at the end of World War II. And as we mentioned, it's quite possible that a lot of the money that was used by the Vatican and Western intelligence and other operatives to get Nazis out of Eastern Europe probably came from the Operation Bernhardt counterfeit money, which was then taken out, passed, and turned into actual spendable currency. Now, bearing that in mind, as we talked about early on, and that was one of the earliest of the sort of damning collaborations between the Vatican, the CIA, and the Nazis. And bearing in mind what we've been talking about this massive Nazi underground movement throughout Latin America, much of which has received direct and overt support from P2 and other groups. We're going to read this next article, which was sent to us by a listener, and also translated by a listener.
Right.
And the article was originally from Il Giornale for November 29th, 1984. And here we are in the last hour, and the talk muscles are beginning to collapse.
By the way, Il Giornale is a Milan daily.
In the ordinance of indictment for the traffic of arms and drugs emerges the thriller of Fortezza. Maybe in the vault of a Swiss bank there is some gold taken by the fleeing Nazis in Rome. The hypothesis emerges from a file seized from an agent of the CIA, a useless attempt by various groups of modern, quote, gold seekers. In short, after various adventures, the treasure of the Bank of Italy was brought to the military compound of Fortezza. There were 80 metric tons of bars. Nobody knows what happened to it, if it has been dispersed or is still there. One thing is for sure. Two railroad boxcars with bars were brought by the Germans to Switzerland and deposited at the UBS. Again, folks, remember the UBS, the Union de Banque Suisse. As we mentioned earlier, Philippe de Vec of the Sniffer Planes affair and also of the Committee of Inquiry into Vatican Bank Finances is the high muckamuck of UBS. If nobody will claim it, the article continues, it will become the property of the bank by the year 2000. This note is contained in a file whose intestation was gold. It opens one of the thousands of chapters contained in the monumental ordinance of indictment deposited last week by Judge Carlo Palermo at the conclusion of his investigation on arms and drugs. This chapter is one regarding the treasure of the Bank of Italy seized by fleeing Nazis in 1944 and various groups of modern gold seekers, which last summer explored the caves underneath the former military compound, convinced that the gold was still there, but found nothing. The fact that some of the gold might still be there is highly improbable, says Judge Palermo, but he also says, quote, judging from our findings, the gold brought to Switzerland might really exist, unquote. The value of that gold, at least 20 metric tons, was 500 million lira in 1944. The actual value today would be in the range of hundreds of billions of lira. But what are the possibilities of the gold being in the vault of a Swiss bank? The judge does not give any clues, but that they, quote, might, and hints at the fact that he has serious doubts. The documents used were talking, the documents we talked about before belong to Glauco Partel, a missile expert who was also working for the CIA, and I just will insert that as we, our understanding was that he was working primarily for the NSA, who is now indicted with the ex-colonel of the SID, Massimo Pugliese, for the traffic of arms and drugs. Among Partel's papers, there was an interview given by an ex-colonel of the SS, Herbert Kappler, when the officer was still at the Salio Military Hospital. In the interview, according to Partel's papers, we read, quote, the operation, over $2 billion in gold and $1 billion in foreign currency, 1944 values, was masterminded by the finance minister, Funk. He sent Dr. Bernhuber to Rome, where he contacted Ambassador Rahm, R-A-H-M. The ambassador sent him to Kappler, who was the security police commander. Kappler does not know what happened to the treasury of the Bank of Italy, unquote. Also, there appear the names of two former German officers, the ex-SS Major Karl Haas and ex-Lieutenant Harold Emke, E-M-B-K-E. The two, the first lives in, that was the word, the first lives in
Albrati Brianz. I can't really say.
I'll
anyway,
buy that.
It's a section of Italy. That's all we can tell you.
I'll buy that. We're reading from the listener's handwriting. The first lives in Albrati Brianz, and the second lived in Rome, where he died 2 years ago. These two former German officers associated themselves with Partel. On the basis of Kappler's declarations, they go to Germany with the intention to contact, quote, all the commanding officers present in Rome at that time, meaning at the time of the evacuation of the gold. We read in Partel's papers, quote, in a later trip, Haas found out for sure that the bars seized by the Germans were in the vault of Lugano's UBS, Union Bank of Switzerland. It is believed that the person to contact in order to get the gold back is the vice president of the Union Bank of Zurich. He is the one responsible for the gold. The best way to get him is by trying to, quote, buy him and that Haas talked to him declaring this intention, unquote. So this is from Partell's notes. In the file is also mentioned a retired colonel, the widow of a duchess, must be the widower of a duchess, holder of a mysterious key of a Swiss bank, where, quote, the real key to get the gold, unquote, could be found. One comment, the man must be kept, quote, under strict surveillance, unquote. Interest in the gold started to decrease while the investigation of Judge Palermo was developing, but somebody gained something out of it. 4 months after his interview, Herbert Kapler successfully escaped from Salio Hospital with his wife's help.
We're going to talk about that escape later in the broadcast.
The fact that the gold is that belonging to the treasury of the Bank of Italy is really a remote hypothesis, the article continues. In May 1948, the governor of the Bank of Italy, in his yearly address, declared, quote, the gold has been given back to the Italian government by the Allies. There is then no change in the reserves that were held. There is one more possibility. The gold is probably there, but might be German gold, stashed away as a, quote, defeat fund by a group of high Nazi figures. At any rate, this is a mystery that so far Judge Palermo has not been able to solve. Now, what's interesting here is the fact that Glauco Partell, a Roman, modern-day Roman rocket engineer with connections to the NSA and to Stibom, obviously, with all of the money that he was involved with, and the Stibom was involved with, also obviously thought enough of this story from what he had heard about it, and apparently had connections with former German officers, that he felt it was worth pursuing and, in fact, interviewing Herbert Kapler about. Now, Herbert Kapler is a very interesting guy. Not only is he a former SS man who managed to escape with his wife's help, among others, from a military hospital, but apparently might be the one man who would know enough about this particular gold to make it worthwhile to help him to escape from the military hospital.
Now, he was a key SS official in Germany, along with, among others, Walter Rauf, at a time when Alan Dulles and James Angleton were recruiting all of the Nazis they could get under the, first Operation Sunrise and then in a post-war operation. One of the interesting things now is to consider that this Nazi gold, which may very well have been derived perhaps from Operation Bernhard or from a victory fund, as they put it there, a resurgence of a fund to finance the resurgence of Nazism, that this money, this gold, was deposited in the Union Bank of Switzerland. Now, recall that in our discussion of the Rat Line, we looked at the fact that Operation Bernhard was begun under the SS, used to finance a joint Vatican-Nazi-U.S. intelligence operation to get Nazis out of Europe, primarily into South America, but mostly working for the U.S. intelligence. Some of the key names there, Walter Rauf, Klaus Barbie, Friedrich Schwend, people that have cropped up later in our broadcast. Then Cardinal Montini, later Pope Paul VI, was one of the key figures involved in that. And according to David Yalop, the Rat Line was set up in no small measure by then SS Oberleutnant Licio Gelli, obviously later Grand Master of the P2 Lodge. Now, the Union Bank of Switzerland is a very interesting place for this money to, for this gold to be on deposit. As we looked at earlier, one of the banking experts called upon by Pope John Paul II to help, quote, straighten out the Vatican finances was none other than Philippe de Vecque, a far right-wing financier, participant in the Sniffer Plane scandal, and an individual who had all sorts of unsavory dealings with not only some of the people in and around Ambrosiano, but also Philippe de Vecque was, again, head of the Union Bank of Switzerland and an ultra right-winger. Now, Licio Gelli also is a person who had connections with the Union Bank of Switzerland, reviewing those briefly from In God's Name by David Yalop. During the same month, August 1982, Gelli was encountering a problem with one of his secret bank accounts in Switzerland. It was not performing to order. Every time that Gelli in South America attempted to transfer money, the UBS in Geneva declined to comply with the instructions. Gelli was told that he would have to appear at the bank in person. Using a fake Argentinian passport, Gelli flew to Madrid and then to Geneva on September 13, 1982. At the bank, he presented his false documentation and was told there would be a short delay. Minutes later, he was arrested. He had walked into a carefully prepared trap. The account had been frozen at the request of the Italian government, which had been informed by the Swiss of the real identity of the account holder. The account had been created for Gelli by Roberto Calvi. Into it, the Milanese banker had poured over $100 million. At the time of his arrest, Gelli was attempting to have the $55 million remaining in the account transferred to Uruguay. So, Union Bank of Switzerland and Philippe de Vecque Interesting place for the gold to be, interesting person to help straighten out the Vatican financing, and remember that Operation Bernhard helps finance the rat line, helped set up by Licio Gelli, with massive involvement by the Vatican and U.S. intelligence. Glauco Partel then interviews Herbert Kapler, one of the top Nazi security officials in Italy at that time, and interestingly enough, Herbert Kapler was able to effect an escape shortly thereafter.
And we're going to read about that from a section of the book Secrets of the SS by Glenn B. Infield, copyright 1981, Stein and Day. When the prominent Chilean exile Orlando Letelier was brutally assassinated in Washington, D.C. in September 1976, few investigators of the crime gave a thought to Hitler's SS at the time. When the American expatriate Michael Vernon Townley testified that he had wired Letelier's car with explosives on orders from the chief of Chile's secret police, General Juan Manuel Contreras, the assassination became a political bombshell in the United States. President Carter demanded that Contreras be extradited to the United States to stand trial, and when Chilean President Augusto Pinochet refused, the U.S. ambassador to Chile was recalled, pushing relations with Chile nearly to the breaking point. However, the CIA, FBI, and investigative agencies of other countries, as they delved deeper into the murder of Letelier, traced the plot back to a secret organization in South America called Operation Condor. Operation Condor, they discovered, is an intelligence-gathering organization that concentrates on leftists around the world, and especially those who are exiled from any of Condor's member countries: Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Uruguay, and Paraguay. According to a top-secret report issued by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Condor has special teams assigned to travel anywhere in the world to assassinate persons on the Condor, quote, hit list. It was then learned, through further investigation, that the headquarters of Condor was in Chile, and the organization worked very closely with the DINA, the Chilean secret police headed by Contreras. The trial then led to an enclave deep in the foothills of the Chilean Andes, south of Santiago, an enclave known only as the Colony to outsiders, but officially named Colonia Dignidad, Noble Colony, by the Chilean government. Regardless of what name it is called, the secret colony is actually a Nazi stronghold that is protected by the Chilean government and which works very closely with the DINA. Informed sources within the Chilean government state that one of the responsibilities of the ex-Gestapo and ex-SS officers at Colonia Dignidad is to demonstrate Nazi torture methods for the Chilean secret police and to instruct the DINA in such brutality. These sources verified that there is a detention camp for Chilean political prisoners within the colony. Colonia Dignidad was established in Chile in 1961 by German ex-Luftwaffe officer Paul Schaefer. He began his organization shortly after World War II in Hallporf, Germany, then moved it to Seeburg, a town near Bonn. Schaefer guaranteed the defeated German citizens both the spiritual and material needs they craved during these harsh post-war years. He also promised anonymity to those Germans who joined his group. This was a powerful lure for many of the SS men on the run from Allied investigators. They quickly joined Schaefer, and when he moved the entire organization from Germany to Chile in 1961, his SS membership was pleased, since South America was known to be a safe haven for unreconstructed Nazis. The reason for the move to Chile has never been verified, but it is thought that Schaefer was guaranteed complete independence for his colony by the Chilean government. In return, Schaefer's SS men were to train the Chilean secret police. During the same period, ex-SS officers and German military personnel were being hired by Argentina, Egypt, and many other countries for the same purpose. Whether or not Skorzeny had a hand in the Colonia Dignidad affair remains a secret. His other such activities elsewhere, however, suggest that he probably did help Schaefer set up the deal with the Chilean government. According to one investigator, Charles A. Krauss, it is not even permissible to take a photograph of the front gate of the enclave. Quote, I was threatened with arrest by police who finally took from me an undeveloped roll of film with pictures of Dignidad's entrance, taken from outside its gates. The police, who wore no identification badges, would only say that they were from Parral, about 20 miles to the west, and that they were acting on orders from Santiago. He did learn that the colony has its own airstrip, its own fleet of aircraft, and a private communication system.
The elaborate communication system permits Schaefer and his colleagues to keep in radio contact with a, quote, mother house in Seaburg and with a mansion in Santiago that is filled with modern electronic communications equipment. The entire 15,000-acre enclave is enclosed by a high barbed wire fence, and citizens of the area say that it is the place where, quote, nobody comes and nobody goes. The proximity of the Argentine border and the private airstrip and fleet of planes makes it easy for inhabitants of the colony to leave and return without any normal customs formalities, and makes an ideal secret hideout for Nazis on the run. Both the CIA and Simon Wiesenthal, the famed Nazi hunter, state they have evidence that such fugitives as Dr. Josef Mengele, the Third Reich's Angel of Death, have spent time at Colonia Dignidad. There is also evidence that Schaefer is in contact with pro-Nazi groups around the world, and that large amounts of money are sent to Colonia Dignidad each year by such groups. The saying that nobody comes and nobody goes at Colonia Dignidad applies only to the regular members of the enclave, not the leaders. When called upon, the ex-SS men of the colony are not reluctant to go any place in the world to help their former SS and Nazi comrades. One such mission in 1977 nearly brought down the government of Italy. Herbert Koppler, a former SS colonel who was serving a life sentence for ordering the execution of 335 civilians in German-occupied Rome in 1944, applied for release from prison 33 years later for humanitarian reasons.
Interrupting, that, of course, is the same individual who told NSA agent Glauco Partel about the Nazi gold in the UBS.